So this afternoon, I'd like to speak on the topic, working with the thinking mind, returning to the heart. And I think there are aspects of teaching the practice where I get excited about sort of conceptually what we're doing and how to frame what we're doing in a way that's understandable, and to frame it in a way that takes advantage of teachings that have come before us that we can use in our practice. So I'm going to share a few teachings from the Jewish tradition and from Jewish texts and from later Jewish thinkers about those texts, and sharing a couple of texts from the Buddhist tradition as well, and all about the topic of thinking. And I'm going to go do two talks while we're here. So this afternoon is one, and on a Saturday afternoon, I think I'll do the other one. And that one will be about the work of the heart, and more about love. And this one is a little bit is much more about the thinking mind. But both are aspects of the word lev. So lev in Hebrew, which is a word usually gets translated heart, really is the heart mind, the heart mind. And so the heart mind, one of the processes of the heart mind is thinking. That is something that the heart does, the heart mind does. And I believe a more fundamental aspect of the heart mind is love and loving. So I'll focus more on that, but in the next presentation. But I hope to put the context of that even in this framework as well. So I thought we would just start though with a song, and probably finish with it as well, and maybe use it in the middle. And that is a. But I won't explain it all now, but I'll just tell you what it means. So there's a starts out with the Hebrew word ayeka, which means where are you? So here's the Hebrew, here's the transliteration. And the response to ayeka that I want us to work with, that I think is about the practice, is ani ba. Okay, I'm coming. Where are you? I'm coming. The practice is sort of both of those things, but we're trying to show up, trying to show up. Where are you? I'm coming. So I thought I would start with the conclusion, in case I get lost in thoughts, talking about thoughts and talking about concepts. So I hope that this is what you get out of the presentation. So one of the things that I hope we'll do this week, and this is a I hope this presentation convinces you the value of it is we're going to pay attention to our thoughts. We want to pay attention to the thoughts in the mind. We've started today focusing on sensations in the body, but we are going to pay attention to the thoughts in the mind. You've had, obviously, thoughts in your mind while we're doing this, but we're going to pay attention to that, too. That is part of the practice. And we want to pay attention to thinking and the thinking process. A second point I hope you'll get out of this presentation is that it's not good to take your thoughts too seriously. And related to that, the third point I hope will be clear is that we should be open to seeing deeper meaning than the apparent content of our thoughts. So there's a content and a storyline to the thoughts, but perhaps we can find a deeper meaning in that. As we do the practice this week, I hope we'll notice two kinds of thought. I'll speak about that. But the point of the practice is to actually notice these two kinds of thought. And I grouped them into two groups. So you want to be able to notice thoughts in group one I called thoughts of sensual desire. Actually not original. This is going to come out of a teaching from the Buddha. So it's not that I called it this. Actually, the Buddha called it this. But in this talk, group one is thoughts of sensual desire, thoughts of ill will, and thoughts of harmfulness. You may have noticed some of those kinds of thoughts. If not today, other times in your life. And at the same time, we also have other thoughts in the second group, restraint of compulsive desire, which when we get to the text, you'll see the word that was translated was renunciation. But I think this is a little closer to what I mean by that, how we could work with that word. I don't like the word so much, but it's a fine word. But thoughts of kindness and compassion, thoughts of generosity. And then here in the middle is the Hebrew word for thought. These three letters, chet, shin, and bet, choshev. I should have written down what those sounds of those letters, but not so critical. So we're going to look at two. So I hope we'll. I'm going to explain the two kinds of thoughts and how to work with them. Another point will be not to learn how to not feed the thoughts in group one, and at the same time, how to encourage the thoughts in group two. That's another part of the practice. We want to, in our practice, learn to recognize and realize, the way Joanna mentioned, we want to recognize the deep connection of thoughts to what is being experienced in the body. We've been, both of us, focusing a lot already on, okay, what's happening in the body? We started with the breath, what's happening in the body? We started with the feet, what's happening in the body? So as we come and start working more directly with awareness of thoughts, we want to start to see the connection between thoughts and what's going on in the body. We want to learn with our practice, whenever possible, to return to the awareness that happens in this body. So we'll work with thoughts, but continually we want to come back to what's happening in the body. And related to that, we want to pay special attention to noticing heartfelt experience in the body. So we're going to pay attention to all sorts of bodily sensations, but within that, we want to pay special attention to those heartfelt sensations, the sensations that that come in the heart area. And finally, learn the lesson of listening and returning to the heart, learning to listen to the heart and return to the heart whenever we're lost in our heads, whenever we're lost in thought. So now I'll try to elucidate the conclusions so that we can reach what I'm talking about. So when we sit here, when we do this practice, we're saying sit down or walk, whatever, all the time here this week, let's pay attention. And as we try to pay attention, we put ourselves into a conducive place where it's quiet and where there's nothing else to do. There's a little bit of work practice, but even there, the point really is to pay attention. What's happening now? What's happening now? When we put ourselves into this setting, and we say pay attention, what is it you notice? What do you notice moment by moment? So probably you notice sensation, but I would imagine you also notice, if you're paying attention, there's a lot of thinking going on, incessant thinking. maybe compulsive thinking, but a lot of thinking, thinking about this and thinking about that and thinking and thinking and thinking. So I'm imagining you all noticed that, that as we try to pay attention, especially when it's quiet, we don't have to do anything, it's like, oh, there's still a lot of thinking going on, thinking and thinking and thinking. And sort of coming along with that thinking, we forget to pay attention. We get lost in the thinking again. We start thinking about this and thinking about that. And we forget to pay attention. Even though in some ways it's the only instruction, just pay attention. But we forget to pay attention. Forget to pay attention. And so we want to learn to work and see what the relationship is to forgetting to pay attention and the thoughts that are going on, learning how to pay attention to the thoughts. So we're not trying to stop any thinking from going on, and that, although there will be some references to stopping thinking in its tracks to some degree, but it's not primarily what I'm speaking about. Primarily I'm talking about, can we be aware when thinking is going on? Can we work with it? And that's ultimately more important than, can you be aware of the sensations of the breath? But they're not, it's not necessarily possible to do one so well without the other. And the working with the breath will have an incredibly important way of taking us into being able to pay attention to what we're thinking about. So we want to be able to notice what we're thinking about so that we're not controlled by our thoughts, not swamped by our thoughts, so that we can continue to pay attention and not only pay attention through the lens of our thinking and not be swamped by it. We want to understand what that thinking is and how it works. We want to be able to put it to good use. So I want to start with some teachings then. I'm going to start with teachings that come out of various traditions, and also a teaching that sort of came to me as a story from my life, which some of you have heard. It's in my book. But I haven't told it for a while. I'm excited by it anyway. So this is a, but first we'll start with what's called the Dvaita Vitaka Sutta. So dve is two in many languages. Even the T-W-O is really the same letters. And in Russian it's dva. So it just means two, and vitaka is conceptions. So there's two kinds of conceptual thinking. So that's the name of the sutta, two kinds of conceptual thinking. The Blessed One said, "Monks, before my self-awakening, when I was still just an unawakened bodhisatta." Now, bodhisatta is not a bodhisattva, it's a different word. A bodhisatta is one bound for enlightenment. He's talking about in that life when he became enlightened, so to speak, just before that, he was not that. He was trying to go that direction, let's say. He's talking about his mind, like our minds. Notice that he noticed it was filled with thinking, lots of thinking. So when I was still just an unawakened bodhisatta, the thought occurred to me, why don't I keep dividing my thinking into two sorts? So I made thinking imbued with sensuality, thinking imbued with ill will, and thinking imbued with harmfulness one sort, and thinking imbued with renunciation, thinking imbued with non-ill will, and thinking imbued with harmlessness another sort. You say I sort of translated them a little bit. As I remained thus heedful, ardent, and resolute, thinking imbued with sensuality arose in me. Right? You recognize that. I discerned that thinking imbued with sensuality has arisen in me. That's like a practice instruction. So that he noticed that thought arise, and he says, oh, I see, I'm thinking about sensuality. Thinking imbued with sensuality arose in me. I'm going to stop commenting on all of this. I'll let you sort of feel your way into the verses now. I discerned that thinking imbued with sensuality has arisen in me, and that it leads to my own affliction, or to the affliction of others, or to the affliction of both. It obstructs discernment, promotes vexation, and does not lead to unbinding. Unbinding might be nibbana, enlightenment. As I noticed that it leads to my own affliction, it subsided. As I noticed it leads to the afflictions of others, to the afflictions of both, it obstructs discernment, promotes vexation, and does not lead to unbinding. As I noticed that, it subsided. Whenever thinking imbued with sensuality had arisen, I simply abandoned it, dispelled it, wiped it out of existence. Seems like a little different tack than he was just saying. And As I remained thus heedful, ardent, and resolute, thinking imbued with ill will arose in me. Now it's more or less going to repeat, so I'll say it quicker. I discern that thinking imbued with ill will has arisen in me, and that it leads to my own affliction, or to the affliction of others, or the affliction of both. It obstructs discernment, promotes vexation, and does not lead to unbinding. The pattern in these texts, because they were memorized, is a lot of repetition, so it may not be how the Buddha first said it. As I noticed that it leads to my own affliction, it subsided. As I noticed it leads to the affliction of others and to the affliction of both. It obstructs discernment, promotes vexation, or does not lead to unbinding, it subsided. Whenever thinking imbued with ill will had arisen, I simply abandoned it, dispelled it, wiped it out of existence. As I remained thus heedful, ardent, and resolute, thinking imbued with harmfulness, that's now the third one, arose in me. I discerned that thinking imbued with harmfulness has arisen in me. And it leads to my own affliction, to the affliction of others, the affliction of both. It obstructs discernment, promotes vexation, does not lead to unbinding. As I noticed that it leads to my own affliction, it subsided. As I noticed that it leads to the affliction of others, the affliction of both. It obstructs discernment, promotes fixation, does not lead to unbinding, it subsided. Whenever thinking imbued with harmfulness had arisen, I simply abandoned it, dispelled it, wiped it out of existence. It gets a little bit newer. Whatever a monk keeps pursuing with his thinking and pondering, that becomes the inclination of his awareness. If a monk keeps pursuing thinking imbued with sensuality and abandoning thinking imbued with renunciation, his mind is bent by that thinking imbued with sensuality. If a monk keeps pursuing thinking imbued with ill will, abandoning thinking imbued with non-ill will, his mind is bent by thinking imbued with ill will. If a monk keeps pursuing thinking imbued with harmfulness, abandoning thinking imbued with harmlessness, his mind is bent by that thinking and imbued with harmfulness. And as I remained thus heedful, ardent, and resolute, thinking imbued with non-ill will arose in me. I discern that thinking imbued with non-ill will has arisen in me, and that leads neither to my own affliction nor to the affliction of others, nor to the affliction of both. It fosters discernment, promotes lack of vexation, and it does lead to unbinding. If I were to think and ponder in line with that, even for a night, even for a day, even for a day and night, I don't envision any danger that would come from it, except that thinking and pondering a long time would tire the body. When the body's tired, the mind is disturbed, and a disturbed mind is far from concentration. So I steadied my mind right within, settled, unified, and concentrated it. Why is that? So my mind would not be disturbed. I find that text pretty clear, pretty straightforward and pretty clear. What to look at, how it could work. Now here's another sutta. This is called the Bahya Sutta. Bahya was a person who came to the Buddha. I've heard that on one occasion, the Blessed One was staying near Savatthi at Jetta's Grove, Anattapindika's monastery. And on that occasion, Bahya of the bark cloth was living in Suparaka by the seashore. He was worshipped, he was revered, honored, venerated, and given homage, a recipient of robes, alm foods, lodgings, and medicinal requisites for the sick. So he's an important guy too, has a following. Then, when he was alone in seclusion, this line of thinking appeared to his awareness. Now, of those who in this world are arahants, who are enlightened, or have entered the path of arahantship, am I one? Then a devata, which is a heavenly being, who had once been a blood relative of Bahya of the bark cloth, compassionate, desiring his welfare, knowing with her own awareness the line of thinking that had arisen in his awareness, went to him, and on arrival said to him, "You, Bahya, are neither an arahant, nor have you entered the path of arahantship. You don't even have the practice whereby you would become an arahant or enter the path of arahantship." And so he said, "Well, then who in this world, with all its devas and arahants, have entered into the path of arahantship?" So the devata answers him, "Bahya, there is a city in the northern country named Savatthi. There, the Blessed One, an arahant, rightly self-awakened, is living now. He is truly an arahant and teaches the Dhamma leading to arahantship." So then Bahya, deeply chastened by the devata, left Suparaka that right then and there, in the space of one night, went all the way to where the Blessed One was staying near Savatthi at Jetta's Grove, Anattapindika's monastery. Now, on that occasion, a large number of monks were doing walking meditation in the open air. He went to them and on arrival said, "Where, venerable sirs, is the Blessed One, the Arahant, rightly self-awakened, now staying? We want to see that Blessed One, the Arahant, rightly self-awakened." And they say to him, "The Blessed One has gone into town for alms." So he's on alms rounds, collecting food. He was a mendicant, so he didn't have possessions, and he lived off of the grace and of other people giving him food. And that was called alms rounds. He's gone into town for alms. Then Bahya hurried, leaving Jetta's Grove, and entering Savati, saw the Blessed One going for alms in Savati. Serene and inspiring, serene confidence, calming his senses at peace, his mind at peace, having attained the utmost tranquility and poise, tamed, guarded, his senses restrained, a great one. Seeing him, he approached the Blessed One and on reaching him, threw himself down with his head at the Blessed One's feet and said, "Teach me the Dhamma, O Blessed One. Teach me the Dhamma, the teachings, O one well gone, that will be for my long-term welfare and bliss." When this was said, the Blessed One said to him, "This is not the time, Bahya. We've entered the town for alms." A second time, Bahya said to the Blessed One, "But it's hard to know for sure what dangers there may be for the Blessed One's life, or what dangers there may be for mine. Teach me the Dhamma, O Blessed One. Teach me the Dhamma, O one well gone, that will be for my long-term welfare and bliss." A second time, the Blessed One said to him, "This is not the time, Bahya. We're here on alms rounds." A third time, Bahya said to the Blessed One, "But it's hard to know for sure what dangers there may be for the Blessed One's life, what dangers may be for mine. Teach me the Dhamma, O Blessed One. Teach me the Dhamma, O one well gone, that will be for my long-term welfare and bliss." So then it's the shift here. Three times, yes. Then, Bahya, you should train yourself thus. So here's the Buddha's answer. In reference to the seen, there will only be the seen. In reference to the heard, only the heard. In reference to the sensed, only the sensed. In reference to the cognized, only the cognized. That's how you should train yourself. When for you there will only be the seen in reference to the seen, only the heard in reference to the heard, only the sensed in reference to the sensed, only the cognized in reference to the cognized, then, Bahya, there is no you in connection with that. When there's no you in connection with that, there's no you there. When there's no you there, you are neither here nor yonder, nor between the two. This, just this, is the end of suffering, the end of stress. Through hearing this brief explanation of the Dhamma from the Blessed One, the mind of Bahya of the bark cloth, right then and there, was released from effluence through lack of clinging. Having exhorted Bahya of the bark cloth with this brief explanation of the Dhamma, the Blessed One left. Now, not long after the Blessed One's departure, Bahya was attacked and killed by a cow with a young calf. Then the Blessed One, having gone on alms in Savati, after the meal, returning from his alms round with a large number of monks, saw that Bahya had died. On seeing him, he said to the monks, "Take Bahya's body, monks, and place it on a litter and carry it away, cremate it, and build him a memorial. Your companion in the holy life has died." Responding, "As you say, Lord," to the Blessed One, the monks, placing Bahya's body on a litter, carried it away, cremated it, and building a memorial, they went to the Blessed One. On arrival, having bowed down to him, sat to one side. As they were sitting there, they said to him, "Bahya's body has been cremated, Lord. His memorial has been built. What is his destination? What is his future state?" "Monks, Bahya of the bark cloth was wise. He practiced the Dhamma in accordance with the Dhamma and did not pester me with issues related to the Dhamma." It's got this one little teaching. Bahya of the bark cloth, monks, is totally enlightened. Then, on realizing the significance of that, the Blessed One, on that occasion, he exclaimed, "Where water, earth, fire, and wind have no footing, there the stars don't shine, the sun isn't visible, there the moon doesn't appear, there darkness is not found. And when a sage, a Brahmin, through sagacity has realized this for himself, then from form and formless, from bliss and pain, he is freed." So that's the sutta. And it's a little less clear to me. I mean, the first one was really clear what to do. This one is, you know, I'd heard this teaching, and the seeing is just the seeing, and the hearing is just the heard. But it's a little less clear to me in that poetic piece at the end. It's also like, you know, earth, water, fire, wind. It was a little less clear. Uh-huh. I heard this, I was just on a retreat in July where this sutta was given, and then this next one was given, which I hadn't ever heard, which was related to this, which made, I never quite appreciated the fullness of that teaching. In the seen, there's just the seen, and the heard, there's just the heard. So now in the Kalaka Sutta, now the Buddha who's already after his enlightenment, so before his enlightenment, he was talking about this thought and that thought, and these thoughts and those thoughts, and working with them. So after that, he says, thus, monks, the Tathagata, which is a term for him being a being who is post-enlightenment, when a Tathagata, when seeing what is to be seen, doesn't construe an object that was seen. He doesn't construe an unseen. He doesn't construe an object to be seen. So he doesn't make up, in this, he doesn't make up an object, and he doesn't construe a seer. So he doesn't make up things that are seen from what's unseen. He doesn't make up a thing that was seen. In the seeing, there was seeing, but nothing was, not, there's no object that was being seen, and there's nobody doing the seeing. And that was sort of all there in the first one, but that got a little clearer to me. Maybe because I was ready to hear it. So this is the story from my life that it was before I had been introduced to, I'd heard of meditation, but before I had begun to practice contemplative practice, before I had met Sylvia Boorstein, who was my first teacher, before I started sitting on meditation retreats. One day I was driving my car and headed on NPR, and a voice came on that I instantly recognized from my high school, from like when I was a kid and in high school. It was the voice of one of the Green Bay Packers. His name was Lionel Aldrich, and he was a star player on the Packers. I was very interested in football growing up, the Green Bay Packers are a very big thing where I grew up, and he was a star player on the championship team that won the first couple Super Bowls. I knew him as a player, and then after that, he became a play-by-play commentator. So that's why I knew his voice. I mean, I knew his voice really well, because if you'd listen to him on TV and radio, you'd always hear him talking about the game. So his voice was instantly recognizable. So I hear, catches my attention, and like, here's Lionel Aldrich talking. Before they said who it was, I go, oh, that's Lionel Aldrich. And he was talking about mental illness. So after all that, after he'd been a superstar football player and a paid sports and TV commentator, he developed serious mental illness, and he became psychotic. He started hearing voices. I don't know if I'm using that term right. He started hearing voices and was dissociated, and he wound up living on the streets. He was completely out of touch with reality, and I was a street person, and at some point, he hadn't been seen for a while, his friends or relatives, somebody, he told the story, I don't remember all the details, they went looking for him, and they found him living on the street, they got him into treatment, he took drugs that reduced the psychosis, and he was sort of able to resume a normal life again, and he was giving this interview because now he was spending his time going across the country speaking about mental illness and how we need to treat mental illness differently and treat the people differently. So he was doing really good work around that. And then the interviewer asked him a question and he said, are you still on the drugs? And he said, yeah, I'm still on the drug, but I take a much, much smaller dose now. I sort of reduced the dose until I took just what was needed. And then the person said, well, do you still have strange thoughts that come to you? And he said, yeah, occasionally I notice strange thoughts beginning to arise, but I just decide not to think them. I was floored when I heard that. I mean, what do you mean you could decide not to? That thought had never crossed my mind, that you could decide not to think a thought. Maybe it's obvious now because we're doing this practice, but when I heard that, you could decide not to say, I just like, wow. And sort of when I learned this practice, it's like that's part of what I learned. I guess you could always do it, but just it never crossed my mind that you could not think something you were thinking. You just were thinking it. So So that gave me a lot of space, something that really opened inside of me about thinking when I heard that. Right, so now I want to share some Jewish verses, Jewish teachings about this topic. And it's pretty funny. And but I looked it up. I looked up, okay, Jewish texts on thinking, because you don't quite find such explicit stuff until you get to Hasidic teaching. But so this is what came up when I tried to find verses, Jewish verses on thinking. So one was from Genesis 37. They're talking about Joseph being thrown in the pit. So one of the verses about thinking is, and they took him and they cast him into a pit, and the pit was empty. There was no water in it. So that's the Jewish verse on thinking. I'll come back to it in a minute. It's not so clear what the relationship is. And then another one came up from the Talmud. Again, this is supposedly about how to work with the thinking mind. This is from Sukkah 28a. It was said that whenever Rabbi Yonatan ben Uziel sat down to delve into the Torah, any bird straying over his head was burnt by his words. And then related to that was another teaching, no fly passed over the table of the prophet Elisha. This is how the rabbis were talking. And I'll tell you how later somebody said, oh, this is all about thought and the way the mind works. But you'd never have known it, right, if you just listened to the text. And then there's a text that you at least have heard before, probably. And God said, let there be light. And God said, let there be light. Vayomer Elohim, yehi or, vayehi or. So these are Jewish verses that later people will say, this is all about the thinking mind. These are teachings about the thinking mind. But it took sort of 3,500 years before Hasidic commentators then explain those verses in a way that you'll see a little later in the presentation are pretty similar to what was talked about in these suttas. So it does raise a question a little bit, why look at these Jewish verses? Why? I mean, it's here. You want to work with the mind? Here's how to work with the mind. I was just talking with my friend Brian Walt about this weekend. I spent the weekend with him. The reason is because the Jewish verses and the stories, especially the stories in Genesis and Exodus, they're a lot more like our minds. That's what it's like. So, yeah, we need to do these things to understand thinking. But when we look at our minds are just filled with these same kinds of stories. And we need to be able to look at these crazy stories that are going on in our mind and get somewhere with them. And I think that's one of the reasons that it's really worthwhile. The stories in Genesis and Exodus are just like us. It's about hating your parents, about having sibling rivalry, about murder, about wanting to kill somebody, good guys, bad guys, enemies. So you want to pay careful attention to that. That's what Jewish teachers have done for the last 3,500 years. They paid very careful attention to those stories and unfolded them in a way that gave us the same kinds of teachings. And they got it by looking at their craziness, in essence, or we can get it by looking at our craziness. So these are some of the things, I think, that if we start paying attention to your thinking mind, these are some of the things you notice that are connected to the thinking mind. You probably notice some or most of these things. Fear, when you're thinking about this, sometimes you notice there's fear, there's expectations, there's opinions, views, beliefs. I think you might sometimes feel with confusion, a sense of separation, a sense of an identity, a sense of a dualistic experience that we're cut off from the rest of the world. But that's one kind of thinking we might notice. Now I'm not sort of using this formula. But there's also, if you pay careful attention to your thinking, there are also sometimes when there's amazing wisdom and insight. We have thoughts that are amazingly insightful. We have beautiful, wholesome intentions. Sometimes you notice the intention to practice more, to try to be compassionate. Thoughts, we worked with a thought, Joanna worked with a thought, always give when asked. And then you let that thought percolate in your mind, always give when asked. That's a beautiful thought, always give when asked. We have compassionate thoughts where we think about taking care of people who are suffering. We have thoughts that inspire us, inspirational thoughts. We have thoughts of gratitude, thoughts of appreciation and beauty. So the thinking mind has all of those kinds of things. So when I learned, one of the things I learned on a retreat about working with the thinking mind was I did a fairly long retreat with a teacher from Burma, Sayadaw Janaka. And his opening instruction wasn't the opening instruction of like sit and notice the breath arising and passing, but in the first private discussion with them. And they call it interviews. We call them practice discussions, but they call it interviews because they interview you. He interviewed me, you know. So because he would, I'd walk into a practice, what we call practice. I'd walk into an interview with him, and his first question was, "Your progress, Jeff. Your progress, Jeff. He wants me to report on my progress in the practice." So I damn well wanted to make progress. So that was the first question he's going to ask, but. It's a very linear approach, not even the approach for so much taking in a certain way. Besides, that's how he opened every talk. But in the first time that I was going to see him on this long retreat, the question was, and we sat for an hour and walked for an hour, and sat for an hour and walked for an hour. The question was that he asked was, and this was like, again, sort of the opening question that you then want to make progress on, was, so when you sit for an hour, walk for an hour, are you aware of every single thought that arises? Are you aware of every single thought that arises? So that's like a high bar. Not just to be aware of thoughts arising. It's like, can you be so present and keep the witnessing what's happening now, so strong that you could notice every single thought arising? That was sort of like, that's where you want to practice. Now in that practice, it sort of became possible. After a couple of days, I could say yes. But the reason I could say yes is not necessarily every single sit. The reason I could say yes is because one of the practices was the practice of mental noting. So in your mind, you kept saying over and over, whatever was happening, if you're walking, it was lifting, moving, dropping, touching, pressing, lifting, moving, dropping, touching, pressing, lifting. And not outside of breathing in, breathing out, breathing in, breathing out. So there was a constant stream of thoughts, because mental noting is a thought process. It's short thought notes of what you're noticing. Because that process got to be so strong, I could go through a sitting period where I was saying that every moment, except every so often, a thought would arise. But it was obvious. When a thought arose, it was just obvious. Sitting, walking, sitting, lifting, moving, placing, lifting, moving, placing. I don't like this teacher. You notice it instantly. Almost every thought that arose was a negative comment about the teacher. Because I was aversive to what was going on in a certain way. And that was pretty obvious, too. It was sort of transparent that I don't like this practice, and I don't like that he's asking me if I'm making progress, and what a jerk, whatever. It probably wasn't that bad, but it hardly, in an hour, it was lifting, moving, placing, maybe four or five times I'd get distracted. But it wasn't that my mind was empty or anything. I was thinking about lifting, thinking about moving. In between, it was like if you're going to a door, okay, lifting, reaching, grasping, turning, just kept that going, reach, pulling, lifting, moving, placing, lifting, and then you walk through, or lifting the floor, lifting, tasting. Oh, this is very good. You notice that thought if you're doing the mental noting, so you could more or less track every thought. But I sort of thought I got in a certain way deceived by that, because in some ways I just it became like something to accomplish. And the point is not so much, can you notice every single thought, but can you see the benefit of noticing every single thought? Because if you notice your thoughts, then you see some really important things. So it was not so much about being successful in noticing every single thought. It was about try to notice all your thoughts so that you can see how they work on you. But the point was to see what's in the thought. That's where the learning comes from, not reaching some level of being able to do it. But I sort of just figured that out this last July. It was 8 years later or something, because I was practicing open awareness there. And then sort of the goal got to be, I could get through a whole walking period. Now I was aware of this. And I was like, good, see, I did it. That's not the point. That's not the point at all. The point is like, oh, now I was aware of this, and I had this reaction to that, and then I was aware of this, and then I had this reaction to that. That's the point, is to see that. So awareness of thinking is where we need to head in this practice. And the point of our practice is even when the Buddha, when he was just a bodhisattva, was like, oh, yeah, there's a lot of thinking. I noticed these thoughts, I noticed these thoughts, I noticed these thoughts, these thoughts. So I decided to do this with them since they were happening. And I noticed, well, let's classify these. So that our practice is to notice thoughts, to notice what thoughts are coming in the mind. But we're starting, in order to get there, you may have noticed, we started with the body. We're starting with the body because the body is here and now. It's a way of bringing our attention. If we're going to pay attention to what's happening here and now, we need to bring our attention into the here and now. So the first thing we're starting with is paying attention to the body because it's in the here and now. And the breath is a subset of paying attention to the body. And we're paying attention to the body and the breath because it gives us an anchor. Just like I was saying, those thoughts, okay, lifting, moving, placing, moving, that gave me an anchor, a reference point to noticing when thoughts happen. So if you can pay attention with the breath, you may not have noticed this yet, but because you're trying to pay, if you have the assignment to pay attention to the breath and lots of thoughts arise, I'm sure you noticed that, lots of thoughts arise. If you compared a 45 minutes of when you were trying to pay attention to the breath and the thoughts that arose to some random 45 minutes when you're out there in your life, if I came up to you and said, what did you think of the last 45 minutes? If I just ran into you in the street, you might know a couple things, but I'll bet here in the 45 minutes when you had incredible trouble paying attention to the breath for a long period, you could recite far more of the thoughts that you had in that period just because they were noticeable. I was trying to pay attention to breath, but I wasn't. I was thinking about this, and then I was thinking about that, and then I was thinking about this, and then I was thinking about that. I couldn't get back to the breath because then this happened, and then this. You sort of know all those things. It gives you a reference point. So that's another reason for doing it. And then the final really, really important reason is if we can know what's happening in the body, there's an incredibly close association to what's happening in the body and the subsequent thoughts in the mind. So when we start paying attention to thoughts, we don't want to leave the body behind, because if we try to be aware of our thoughts, if we notice what's happening in our body preceding a thought, you'll see the connection. It'll be a great source of wisdom for why you're thinking what you're thinking. Returning to the two kinds of thoughts here. So the Buddha, like us, was having all these thoughts. He classified these thoughts into these two things. That's what it's a good practice you could do. Just notice, oh, here's an aversive thought. Here's the thought of, I'm having all these thoughts, but you might really want to classify them. These are wholesome thoughts. These are generous thoughts. This was a generous thought. This was a thought inspired to work harder, to try to pay attention. Oh, why should I do this? This is ridiculous, you know. The schedule's too hard. Or the thoughts I had, you know, that I didn't like the teacher, Ujjanika. I didn't like the teacher, he was working us too hard. Whatever the thought might be, those are thoughts of ill will. That's a thought of ill will has arisen. So we want to notice those, see if you can notice those things. And you want to, as you're doing that, since we already said this, try to notice how those thoughts are connected to what you're feeling in your body. And you sort of all know this, but it's worth pointing out over and over again. If you're noticing something pleasant on the sensory level, most likely you'll have thoughts of desire for sensory pleasure, of keeping that pleasant thing, wanting the pleasant thing to continue. That kind of wanting is in this category. If it's unpleasant, also generates things in this category. I don't want this. I don't like this. I got to get rid of this. I shouldn't do this. A lot of the thought goes into holding on to what's pleasant and getting rid of what's unpleasant. And if you see that every time you notice the connection between what's happening in your body and one of those things arising, that's how you realize, as Joanna was saying, that's how you realize. We know it's true. Everybody believes that if you have something pleasant, you'll probably cling to it. But when you see it happening over and over, you realize the depth of that. So then he says, back in that sutta, thinking imbued with sensuality has arisen in me, and I see that it leads to my own affliction, or to the affliction of others, or to the affliction of both. It obstructs discernment, promotes vexation, does not lead to unbinding. So Certainly what I've noticed, I have a lot of desire. That's some people are desire types. Some people have more aversive thoughts in their minds. Some people have more sort of rapid thinking and doubt and confusion. Should I do this? Should I do that? But I have a lot of desirous thoughts, you know. I can certainly get compulsive and addictive around sweets, you know. If I don't eat sweet foods, it's much easier. But if I do, I notice wanting that. And in general, I notice with sensory pleasure things, there's wanting, and then there's more wanting, and then there's more wanting. And you can't get everything you want all the time. It's problematic. It causes you vexation, right? Because it's like, I'm uncomfortable. I'm unhappy wanting all that stuff. I'm not, you know, sort of fantasizing getting it is sort of a pleasant thought, but not getting it, which is what happens. Most of the stuff you fantasize getting is like, it's really frustrating and vexating and makes me irritated and unhappy that I'm not, whatever, not getting all those things. And not only that, if I have those thoughts and keep trying to get things, it causes vexation for the people around me. I either want it from them, want them to give me those things, that causes them consternation and vexation, or not getting it from them, then it leads to unhappiness. So that kind of thinking is not good for me, it's not good for the people around me. Yeah. And then the next one, as I noticed that it leads to my own affliction, it subsided. I've noticed that's true. It's like, you know, not all the time. Sometimes I just keep wanting, but other times it's like, oh, you know, it's like, it's making me nuts, you know. And it's not that I try to stop it even. We're going to get to that line, okay, because he also does say, I just decide to stop thinking it, you know. But sometimes it's like, and this is, I think, more the direction we're going, which Joanna already introduced last night. You don't really have to do anything to just watch it. You don't really have to do anything to change it. We're so into trying to change and get rid of the bad stuff and seeing ourselves as bad and not good enough. There's enough power. I find there's enough power just in the watching. In the watching, sometimes the desire fades because you notice everything's impermanent. So desire just fades. You don't have to do anything about it. It just fades away because of its impermanent nature. But other times, you just stop doing things because, you know, you get a headache every time you eat this, you know. As much as you like that, you get disenchanted. That's a good word. You get disenchanted with the things that were enchanting. For a while, you're enchanted by these things. Then you get disenchanted. But it wasn't because you said, I'm not going to think this. It's because you saw the consequence of thinking it over and over. So you actually pay attention to it. That's a different way how it can subside. But then there also, he does say there's another thing too, that when you notice it, there is another possibility, which is whenever thinking imbued with sensuality had arisen, I simply abandoned it, dispelled it, wiped it out of existence. Like, I just decide not to think that thought. Same sort of teaching that I had heard from Lionel Aldrich. You know, he was a Buddha. He sort of figured this out. He didn't know anything about Buddhism, I don't think. He figured it out all on his own. I just decide not to think it. No, it's not good for me to think those thoughts. I wind up on the streets if I think those thoughts. I just decide not to think it. It's a little harder to do with compulsive thinking, but it is possible. Sometimes it's easier than other times. Sometimes you just... So what I do sometimes with... this is a somewhat more newer approach is instead of having a thought of desire and thinking, oh, nuts, you know, why is that thought coming up again? And instead of, okay, you know, I'm going to think and figure out when I could get that cookie. I'll do it here. I can do it there. I'll get it. And I don't go either of those directions. I go in the direction of like, oh, desire arose. Ding. Pay attention. It's just like I'm starting to use those moments which I would have wished were going away. Instead, it's like, oh, desire arose. Ding. Wake up. Pay attention. Okay, desire's like this. I'm feeling. And then to drop into the body. Okay, this is what I'm feeling. This is what I want in that moment. Or just drop into the body. Just like, okay, well, I have that thought, but, you know, and it's sort of vexing that I can't have that thing. But actually, my feet feel really nice right now. Walking feels good. Breathing feels good. There's a lot of good stuff happening right now, even though I don't have that stuff. And all I needed to do was just pay attention to this instead of the thing that was vexing. So that's another way I've noticed it works for me. And as I remain thus heedful, ardent, and resolute, then thinking imbued with non-ill will arose in me. So there's another thing that does happen. When you just pay careful attention, so when I noticed, okay, so I'm walking and I notice, oh, all the thoughts I'm having on when I'm distracted on this long retreat, all the thoughts are ill will towards the teacher somehow, some negative comment about the teacher. Oh, and just sort of seeing that, it faded away. It was so transparent. And so, and then I could, once it faded away, then I could appreciate, look, he's teaching me these things and I can notice every thought. And then, wow, I didn't know I could do that. Thoughts of appreciation arise. So just by paying attention to this and letting it run its course, being really wise about how it works, seeing how it's connected to the body, then just in doing that, the more wholesome thoughts sometimes arise. And when it doesn't work quite so quickly or quite so easily, then we can actively go to these kinds of thoughts. So that's what we're doing with the blessing practice. That's why we're teaching it as well. Because maybe, unlike the Buddha in that teaching, we're not just one half step away from enlightenment. That we can just simply dispel those things and automatically the good stuff arises. So sometimes that happens, but sometimes it's good, like, oh, maybe I'll just practice wishing people well. I think I'll spend a couple hours wishing people well now. See how that, that doesn't lead to vexation. That doesn't lead to problems for them. In fact, it makes me more open to them. It's good for me. It's good for them. And then I have noticed, because I've done this practice on retreat, where you practice the phrases all day, every day, all day, every day. He made a really good point here, like, there's no problem with all day, every day, except once in a while you've got to remember the body gets tired. And if the body gets tired, you get really confused. I mentioned the other day about talking to Sylvia. I had a nervous breakdown on a retreat because I'd gotten up at 2 in the morning on that day. It was the 14th day of a retreat. I'd been practicing since 2 in the morning. It was the first day I learned this practice of saying phrases. I started saying, and Sylvia taught it to me about 9 in the morning or something in a practice session. And I just started saying these phrases. I was exhausted. And at some point, I was so tired, my whole body mind crashed. I couldn't remember the phrases. Then I couldn't remember who I was. And then I really panicked. I was so tired from practicing, I couldn't even think. And then I was lost. I was like, I'm sure I had a big shot of adrenaline. I was completely scared out of my mind. I didn't have a mind. I couldn't find a mind. I couldn't get a thought into my head. I was trying to think. I couldn't think. That was really scary. So, and I should have gone and gotten Sylvia when that happened. But so it was actually exactly what the Buddha said. There's nothing wrong with just doing it forever and ever, except once in a while you got to be careful because you get tired and you should rest. And if you don't rest, you get all confused too. So it's great that he said it so clearly like that. I love that teaching. So I'll pick up on this more in my next teaching because it will focus on the love piece. But what I think the opening story of Genesis is about is the origin of this kind of thinking, of conceptual thinking. I don't think Genesis is about the creation of the earth plane, the heaven and earth, the physical body, the planet. It doesn't pretend to be that in lots of ways. It's a misunderstanding. The opening line is in a beginning. It's not in the beginning. It's a beginning, in a beginning. And I think if you look at that text, in some ways, the simple meaning of it, once you open up to another way of seeing that, is this is the story of the creation of human consciousness. And human consciousness, the creation of human consciousness comes about when Homo sapiens start to speak, when they learn language. Because originally they were beings that we think for 100,000 years after the gene changed for Homo sapiens sapiens, they were walking around without conceptual thinking. Only, we don't know how old thing he is, there's lots of theories and concepts about it, but at some point they started thinking the way we think, with concepts. And concepts, that's when they became human beings, not Homo sapiens. And when they had conceptual thinking, that's when they went into seeing things as good and bad. So I think that's what it means when it says they ate from the tree of knowing good and bad. I think before that, that's the origin of dualistic thinking. Concepts are by their nature binary. It says in the Torah that, it says, when the instruction comes not to eat from that tree, it says, because it says God, supposedly God says to them, I think this is, you know, retrospectively, it's projecting onto some divinity that, you know, it set it up this way. But subtly in the projection, the truth, I think, is right there to be seen, which is that somehow we know that when we started, we had the experience that when we started thinking, things started going downhill somehow. So in that story, they eat from the tree of knowing good and evil. It says, surely on the day that you eat from that tree, you will surely die. If you eat from the tree, on that day you will surely die. I think what it's, among other things, what it's telling us, what that text is telling us, is that it wasn't until human beings came into being with conceptual thinking that the illusion of death arose. There's actually no such thing as death. And we have some, there are some aspects to what I think the divine are that don't have opposites. They have opposites because we have a conceptual way of thinking of that. So I don't think bad is the opposite of good. There's just nature, life itself is inherently good. And then we came up with this concept of something that's not that. And then we divided the world into good and bad. I don't think actually they're really separate. And I don't think death is the opposite of life. Death was a concept. There was no death. Even the story said there was no death until they went into this seeing things as good and bad. There was no birth either. So I think birth and death are opposites. I don't think life and death are opposites. Life has no opposite. Life just is. That's why on the other chart, life is connected to the yud. Life is just the way things are before all this conceptual thinking happened. And so there's one other thing that I can come in for a landing on. So there's one other thing before all this conceptual world was created. So before Vayahi Or, because the conceptual world was created through speaking. So when the first act of speaking was, let there be light. But now we're already creating things through words, through concepts. That is sort of one Jewish understanding of how the world came into being, through concepts. I think it is how most of what we experience as the world does come into being, is through concepts and thinking. But even the Torah text has something that was there before thinking, before the first Vayahi Or, before separation began, because I think this is the story of separation. So before that, Ruach was there, this quality that we have associated with the Vav. Before Vayahi Or, it says, Ruach Elohim rachefet al pnei ha-mayim. That even before that, before there was any duality, there was love. So I think Ruach is related to love. And that Ruach is the force in the universe that's bringing stuff together. The whole creation, things are coming together because there's an energy bringing things together, which I would call love. It's the connective force of the universe. It's a connective aspect of being, of life. And it precedes the conceptual worlds that we live in. And so right after, then the story right after follows right along in that teaching, which is they eat from the tree of knowing good and bad. And so now they have this sense of death and murder. The very next story is a murder, too, you know, after that. But or almost the next story. But so they eat from the tree. And when they ate from the tree, they became self-conscious. They weren't self, but we weren't self-conscious. There was no self to be self-conscious. That's a concept. So we had from the tree, they became self-conscious. And then it says, so they eat from this tree, and then it says the voice of God came to them as Ruach Hayom. So the voice of God appeared to them as the Ruach aspect of the day. And nobody knows what that means. So if you look in the English translation, there's asterisks there. It says Hebrew unclear. So some people say, oh, it's the cool part of the afternoon. But it's not. But where the mystics go with it is that the voice of God, the kol, which is the voice of God, is nothing other than this aspect called ruach, called heart. And what happened is when we went into conceptual thinking, we left paradise, so to speak. We left a sense of connectedness, which is vav and love, connectedness. We left that sense of connectedness and started hanging out in our heads with our thinking. And the Zohar says directly about this. It says, from the time of the expulsion, when they ate from the tree, speech went into exile from voice. So speech, which is words and concepts, is in exile from voice. So voice, and voice is ruach, kol is ruach. Voice is the heart, is the message of the heart. What the Zohar is saying is that the head is in exile. In essence, we're in exile with the head's in exile from the heart, and we, thinking beings who are living in our heads and worshiping the things we created, we're in exile from the heart. And what the heart says to you, so in the very next part, then after, when God appears to these beings who are now self-conscious and trying to hide and are lost in the head, the very next thing that happens is coming from the heart, God speaks to them through the heart and says, Ayeka, where are you? Where are you? So like when you get lost in your head, your heart is saying, where did you go? Like we were present, paying attention. Now you're off trying to change things and figure out why it's bad. Like, whoa, just drop back into your heart. Where are you? Where'd you go? Where are you? And we're trying to learn to respond. This isn't in the Tanakh, but we want to respond with Ani Ba. I'm coming. I'm not going to hide. I'm not going to stand that. I'm going to come back to my heart. And that's the practice we want to do. We want to learn to come back in this practice. We want to recognize the thoughts, recognize their positive aspects, their negative aspects, see through our own thoughts, see the underlying story. I didn't get to explain how those other Jewish stories were all about thoughts. But we want to, just like the sages have learned to not take the Torah stories literally, we have to not take our thoughts literally. We have thoughts, but we should learn it whether they're this kind or that kind, and we should try to see what's underneath them, learn something deeper than what the surface story is telling us. And we should trust that the way to do this is to return to the heart, to trust practicing from the place of the heart. Ayeka ani ba, ayeka ani ba, ayeka ani ba, ayeka. You found something helpful in this sharing about what to do as you sit here for the next few days of the retreat, noticing thoughts. So thank you for your kind attention. I offer these concepts for your benefit. So don't spend so much time thinking about it now. It's just paying attention, notice what thoughts arise, and notice feelings arise, going back to the body, going back to the heart, and then seeing the thoughts arising. So thank you for listening.